This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is CoronaCast, a podcast all about the coronavirus. I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan. It's Monday, the 21st of September.
Well, Norman, it was very heartening to see that yesterday, at least in Victoria, there was only 14 new cases and a handful of cases elsewhere as well. So that's really good to see. And the overall number of active cases is also declining in Australia. But there have been tens of thousands of cases overall just in Australia during this pandemic, which really kind of gets you wondering what the long-term effects of COVID are, because we do hear anecdotal reports of prolonged symptoms. What do we know about this so far?
Well, we don't know a huge amount, but there's just been a non-peer-reviewed article coming out of Ireland where they followed 128 people with an average age of 50 over a 10-week period and just watched their recovery. It's similar to a study that they're doing in Australia, just to see how they are going. And over 50%, 52% of them, 67 of them out of 128, were reporting persistent fatigue. You've got to just be a little bit careful with this because you don't want to create an epidemic of fatigue. Fatigue is very much in the eye of the beholder. It's common to get viral fatigue after a severe viral infection. And I remember once I got hepatitis A and I was fatigued for quite some time and you kept on bouncing backwards and forwards. It doesn't mean that you've got chronic fatigue syndrome. It's pretty much a viral fatigue, which will hopefully just go away, but it could take some time. But that's over a 10-week period. So this is not, this is a significant issue as it's been shown elsewhere.
There are a couple of things about this. Oh, it's a conference presentation that I found really interesting. One was that there was no link necessarily between the severeness of the COVID at the acute phase, like while they were sick, and this link to fatigue down the track. And also, women seem to be more likely to report ongoing fatigue.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. So irrespective of the severity of their initial illness, they got this fatigue. And that has been shown in other places as well, particularly in younger people as well. So younger people who've not been in hospital, who've otherwise been fairly well, but had COVID, a few weeks later, they're still feeling fatigued and quite unwell. So I just think that we need far more data on this, but there's no question this phenomenon exists.
And I guess it's just another argument for keeping the number of cases down, because death is not the only bad outcome. It goes without saying, but death is not the only bad outcome here.
That's absolutely right. And people are saying, well, we should just ignore it because the case fatality rate's going down. You know, older people are keeping themselves to themselves and socially distancing, but it still means that younger people are getting the infection and some of them will go on to get chronic fatigue. So the burden will live with us for some time to come.
So, Norman, let's take some questions from the audience. But before we get into it, I just want to give a shout out to Narissa and Widia, who work with me at the ABC Brisbane office, who have been fielding all these questions that have come in over the months of the pandemic. They passed a really crazy milestone over the weekend, 100,000 questions.
It's just amazing.
And they've read and categorized every single one, including this one from Catherine, who's asking, Norman, New South Wales numbers are now looking so much better. How much longer will you wait before you go back to the gym? What's the sign that it's safe enough to get back in there?
Really good question, Catherine. I've just been thinking that myself because I'm getting extremely unfit. Just can feel that softness creeping back in and I'd love to get back to the gym. So just me thinking that myself, I think I'm personally going to give it another week. I just want to see things settling down. No more outbreaks or gyms being nominated as risky areas or places where people have visited. I was thinking I'd leave it for about another week. And if the numbers, I live in New South Wales, stay down, and there are no gyms nominated as high-risk areas in terms of people having visited them, I'd be inclined to go back. But it's a discretionary activity. I can always exercise outside. I can do my push-ups and so on. It's not as convenient as the gym, but it's not as if I can't get any exercise.
Well, speaking of trying to ease back into normal, Daniel's asking, when do you think Victorians could walk safely outside without a mask? What would be the effect of adjusting the policy so that people only need to wear masks when they're inside?
My personal view of this is that Victorians should not go back to not wearing masks. I think mandatory mask wearing should remain. It would be a big mistake to lose it. There's going to be circulating virus for a time. There are fewer people getting tested, so there is going to be virus around. what does it cost to actually have mandatory mask wearing and for quite some time to come, just to keep things under control. What's the cost to it? The cost is minimal. And the thing about wearing it outside is more that you've already got it on when you go inside, when you're going to the supermarket or something like that, or you're going onto a tram or a train, rather than fiddling around with it and getting it on and having to touch it. Whereas if you put it on when you leave the house, it's on when you move indoors or into a riskier area.
But not forever, right? Like, what about when they're back down to, say, the same similar levels to New South Wales?
That's a fair point. But it'll be a while before you get down to those levels. So it's probably the last thing you'd stop doing. And it's the first thing you'd put back in if there's an outbreak.
David's asking, well, he's saying he and his wife are both 65. They're doing everything they can to minimise their chance of infection. And David says his understanding is that the average case fatality rate is about 1%. But what would it be for people in their age bracket?
Well, the average case fatality rate is probably about 0.5% to 0.6% overall. But if you look at the Australian numbers, the last ones that I can find, if you're under 50, it's so low, it's almost zero. If you're between 50 and 64, it's about 0.5%, 0.4%. If you're between 65 and 79, case fatality rate's about 3.4%. And if you're 80 and over, it's 1 in 5. If you get to ICU, sick enough to be in ICU, 70% of people who are 80 and over will die. 18% of people who are 65 and over, and 10% of people who are 50 and over. So if you get bad enough to get into ICU, obviously those escalate, but the overall death rate goes up 3 to 4 times. Now, if you're at the 65-year-old end, you're going to be much nearer 1% than 3.4%, because it will escalate quite quickly. So at 65, it's still not huge, but it does escalate from there.
So just to some feedback and clarification, and Norman, Simon's written in, we were talking the other day, sort of saying that Victorian government wasn't really showing specific places where people had been infectious. And Simon's saying they actually do. It's the DHHS website.
Yeah, no, I stand corrected on that. I'm not quite sure how long they've been doing that for, but when you look, they do find it, and you can find out which public transport means were affected, which shopping centres and so on. They're a bit broad in terms of over a couple of days rather than necessarily on such and such a date between certain hours. But yep, to the credit of DHHS, they are starting to give locations in much more detail. And you can go to that by looking for dhhs.vic.gov.au/case locations and outbreaks.
So we've talked a lot on this podcast about vaccines, and we've talked a lot about the Oxford vaccine and a bit about the UQ vaccine, but there's others being made here in Australia, Norman. What's the latest news?
Yes, Tegan, really great news. These are two Commonwealth-funded vaccine candidates. One is a genetic package similar to ones you've heard about overseas, and the other is a much more traditional vaccine using genetic material from the vaccine itself. So, great news, and we're going to need a lot of vaccine candidates because the initial round might not be that effective, and the second round of vaccines could be the ones that take over, as happened indeed with polio.
Yeah, there's a lot of horses in this race, and it's kind of exciting to see quite a few of them coming out of Australia here.
And we'll be grateful for the first round, but the second round may well be much better vaccines and more effective.
Absolutely. But that's all we've got time for today.
We love your questions. They're what prompt discussion on the show. So if you want to send in one, go to our website, abc.net.au/coronacast, and click Ask a Question, mention Coronacast, so we can find it.
And please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts if you can. I personally take a lot of pleasure in reading them.
And we'll see you tomorrow.
See you then.
Just months after taking office, US President Donald Trump will be threatening North Korea with
fire and fury, like the world has never seen.
And that wasn't the only war on the horizon.
We begin tonight with the US and Iran on the brink.
How did Donald Trump push back on his White House warmongers? I'm Matt Bevan, and that's the story in this week's episode of America If You're Listening on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.